Welcome back to the program. One of the things that seems clear in our society today is that one is no longer the loneliest number. In fact, in many places, living alone has become a luxury. There are currently 32 million Americans living alone. One in seven adults, 20% of all households, are single-person households. Yet there's a big difference between living alone and being alone. The social alienation that Robert Putnam once talked about in Bowling Alone is not necessarily part of this trend. It simply reflects some profound changes in the nature of work, relationships, and social norms. Joining me today to talk about this trend of living alone is our guest, Eric Kleinenberg. He's a professor of sociology at New York University and the editor of the journal Public Culture. It is my pleasure to welcome Eric Kleinenberg here to talk about his newest work, Going Solo: The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Eric Kleinenberg, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it's good to be back.
It's great to have you here. One of the things that is so fascinating about this is how recent this phenomenon is, that really before the 50s, this was an idea that people didn't even think about.
Yeah, and not just people in this country, people as a species. Before the 1950s, you cannot find a single society in all of human history that sustained large numbers of people living alone for long periods of time. 60 years later, it's ubiquitous. You find it everywhere. People can afford to do it.
And in examining why this phenomenon has happened, how much of it has to do with economics? How much of it has to do with some of the broader cultural changes that we've seen take place in the past 60, 70 years?
Well, it's some of both. And you got to say up front, living alone is expensive, and so one reason it didn't exist until the 1950s is that people simply couldn't afford to do it. It takes some prosperity and frankly also, the welfare state that provides social security for people through their lives that makes it possible. But there are a lot of things that we can afford to do and that we choose not to do. So there's also a lot of cultural changes that drove this rise in living alone. One of the big things that I emphasize is the rising status of women. And that's both a cultural and an economic thing. But just on the economic side, until the 1950s and 60s, there weren't a lot of women who had the means to afford a place of their own. And as they enter into the paid labor force, suddenly they get a control of their lives that they didn't have.
And, of course, this is a phenomenon, this aspect of it is something that is continuing to increase, particularly as we see the nature of relationships change, the nature of work change as far as men and women are concerned. I mean, the recent Kate Bollock's recent Atlantic story kind of goes to the heart of this.
That's right. We are seeing an incredible transformation in the lives of women. And, it's in many respects a very liberating change. The fact that women have this kind of purchasing power and this relative economic success has meant, for instance, single women are now the fastest growing part of the home buying market. The real estate world has completely noticed this. On the other hand, there are some real challenges that this creates. So, for instance, women who are living alone when they hit their mid-30s and early 40s face very tough questions about whether they're going to have biological children, whether they should settle on someone and go into a relationship that they might not be completely wild about going into. It can be a very troubling experience at certain moments.
What I find fascinating also is that this is a worldwide phenomenon happening even in China.
I was so surprised to learn this. I mean, when I started the project, I thought, this has to be an American story, right? We are the inheritors of Thoreau and Emerson, and we think about the Lone Ranger and the detectives from the film noir tradition. I mean, we love this kind of solitary, individualistic ideal. But it turns out that the United States is a laggard when it comes to living alone. It's far more common in most European nations. In Scandinavia, it's especially common. And it's rising most quickly in the nations that have fast-developing economies, like China and India and Brazil. So there can't be some simple cultural explanation, given that it's taking place in so many different parts of the world today.
Well, this comes back to this notion that it is kind of an economic luxury in some respects.
Well, again, it's certainly is an economic luxury, but you have to have the demand to do it. So let me talk about some of the things that I think culturally we share with people in different parts of the world that make this possible. One thing we share now is communications technologies. And I think the earliest technologies that make living alone possible and even pleasurable for many people are the telephone and the television set, because with the telephone and the TV, you can be at home, but also be connected to other people and entertained much of the time. And that's very different from the kind of image we have of the solitary figure, kind of, you know, sitting on a chair, feeling lonely or isolated without the kind of the possibility of plugging into some other social world. Of course, by the time you get to the internet, you know, Facebook and social media, cell phones, our capacity to connect with each other is even greater. So one thing culturally that's changed is communication allows us to be alone, but also together.
The other aspect is the degree to which the nature of work has changed, and that work itself at every level is a more collaborative phenomenon, a more teamwork-oriented phenomenon, so that the idea of getting away from that becomes more essential.
That's right, and a lot of the young people I interviewed, because I should say that this incredible increase in the number of young adults who are living alone has been a big shaper of this change. You know, 500,000 young adults living alone in 1950, more than 5 million young adults living alone today. It's a big thing, but interestingly, they're not using their free time to just kind of go out in the city and play all the time. They're also using a lot of it's not so free time. They're also using a lot of their time to work more. In fact, you know, when I first lived alone, it was when I was in my late 20s. I was actually living in the Bay Area as a graduate student, and living alone afforded me a chance to be social, but also I poured myself into my work and my writing. I got a huge amount of stuff done, and I think there's a growing sensibility among people that in a world where there's so much insecurity and uncertainty, where there's so much divorce and economic pain, that people have to invest in themselves and establish their own personal security before they can connect with others and take on these obligations. And so, interestingly, I think that's one reason that we're seeing, even during an economic recession, a pretty steady level of living alone. The work culture demands it.
How much of it also has to do with this lack of separation nowadays between home and work, that the membrane between the two has become so porous?
Right. My former teacher, Arlie Hochschild, used to say, today, home, for many people, home is work and work is home. And that's especially true for a lot of women, I think. Look, in a lot of workplaces, not all, of course, but in a lot of workplaces, people go and do a lot of socializing. A lot of people who sit in front of their computers are, you know, sneaking time onto Facebook or email. Other people are socializing with their colleagues, you know, going out together after work. There's a whole culture in, you know, cities like, you know, San Francisco or Los Angeles or Seattle, you know, of people who go downtown to work and then they just kind of hang out with their colleagues at the end of the day, playing sports and going to bars and things like that. There really has been this blurring of the borders between personal life and business life. And it can be exhilarating, but it can also be exhausting for people. And a lot of young adults say having a place of their own is a way to kind of, you know, decompress, to just, you know, shut down a little bit, have time to think about who they are and how they're living and what they want to do. They need that solitude.
We should also talk about the fact that this is, to a large extent, certainly not exclusively, but to a large measure, an urban phenomenon.
Much more so than in the past. In 1950, of the 4 million Americans who lived alone, the real concentrations were in the big northwestern states, you know, for Alaska, Wyoming, Montana. It was a phenomenon that was quite common among migrant working men. Today, people live alone primarily in cities, and they're primarily women who live alone, though I should say under the age of 45, more men than women tend to live alone. That's a surprise for a lot of people. But the numbers are huge. I mean, San Francisco, Seattle, Atlanta, Denver, Minneapolis, these are all cities where more than 40% of the households are one-person households. In Washington, D.C. and Manhattan, where I live, it's almost 50% of all households that are one-person households.
Of course, the phenomenon of people marrying later is also a big factor in this, and of course, the increasing divorce rate.
That's right. Talk a little bit about young adults and they're investing in themselves and actually enjoying being single and dating and having some control over their time, and they see no real rush to get married. So the typical age of first marriage is over 30 in most cities. But the other big change is that, you know, 60 years ago, when couples got divorced, it was very common for women to move back in with family members. Now that they have more economic independence, they're far more likely to live on their own. And one of the very interesting themes that kind of recurred in the interviews I did with people, and I did more than 300 interviews with my research team for this book, is that, you know, people said, in the abstract, I'd want to be in a relationship again after a divorce. They'd love to find the right person, but they're not willing to settle for the wrong relationship because they've experienced this feeling that there's nothing more lonely than living with the wrong person. There's nothing more lonely than being in a marriage that's not quite working. So we're right to be concerned about loneliness as an issue, but it's not only people who live alone.
The other thing that we're seeing is people that are more flexible in terms of cycling in and out of these kind of living arrangements.
We have no choice but to be flexible. You know, the world has become an uncertain one. You know, there are a lot of ups and downs that we experience. And what that means in our personal lives is, you know, unlike a century ago, today people are likely to live alone for a stretch of time and then to get married. If the marriage works, that's great. But if it doesn't, you know, people separate and then have a period of time when they're on their own again, then they might marry again. We move in and out of these different conditions. And, you know, in some ways this is liberating for people, but it also puts a lot of pressure on us as individuals to figure out how to live well. So I want to be clear, you know, my book is not an advocacy book. I'm not trying to tell people to live in any particular kind of way. What I'm doing instead is noting this rise of living alone is an enormous and incredibly significant social change. It's one that's touched us as individuals. It's affected our families. It's affected our friendship networks. It's really changed who we are, and it's about time we started talking about it and trying to understand it better.
Is it your sense that there's been a reluctance to talk about it, that this is something that people have not wanted to deal with?
I think that we love to talk about social changes like this, but unfortunately, our vocabulary has been dominated by the language of decline, of atomization, that kind of bowling alone sentiment that we once were much happier being together in these cohesive families and groups, and that the change of our time is that we've all broken apart and we've become isolated. Our social ties have frayed. Our communities are weaker. And my view is that this is not quite the right gloss on mm-hmm. what's happened. And, you know, in fact, if you listen to people in the 1950s and 60s, the golden age of American, you know, community life, according to these books, they were complaining about the same kinds of things. You know, loneliness, isolation, disconnection. For me, you know, I think that we need to develop a different vocabulary for understanding this change. So living alone doesn't necessarily mean that we're more atomized. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're narcissistic and individualistic, because people who live alone are, in fact, on average, more social in many ways than people who are married, and even more likely to volunteer in civic organizations. So we've had conversations about it in some way, but not, I think, with the kind of full perspective that we need.
One of the other questions about it is the broader impact it's having on marriages and relationships. As people live alone, men and women both, into their 30s perhaps, and because they're getting married later, as we talked about before, they become more set in their ways in that situation, and arguably makes it more difficult or certainly more complex when they finally do come together.
Well, I mean, I know that there's that idea out there, but the truth is, if you look at the numbers on marriage and divorce, people are much less likely to mm-hmm. divorce if they get married later in life. And you get married under the age of, say, 25, the divorce rates are far higher. The divorce rates have gone down in recent years. And so I just don't think that the evidence suggests that that's true. I know people have that concern, but I think people are, you know, taking more time to discover who they are and what they want and what they want to live, how they want to live. I think people are being a little more careful about choosing their spouses and making that commitment. And the result is that in American communities where there's kind of a high level of education and some high level of prosperity, marriages are working much better.
Education is also a big part of the demographic equation.
It is. It's not easy to live alone. I mean, it's not easy to live, but living alone requires having some skills and having some money as well. And those things, as we know, are connected. So if you're not very educated, the odds are in this economy, you're probably not going to have a terrific job, and you won't be able to afford living alone. I spent some time interviewing people who are actually very poor and living alone in kind of the urban hotel residences. And for them, living alone is a much more complicated affair. Mm-hmm. It can be more defensive. People live alone when they're very poor in order to escape people or places that might get them into trouble.
Talk a little bit about this whole phenomenon in terms of its international scope that we touched on before. And what are the common reasons why we're seeing this everywhere, why we see it as much in Manhattan as we do in Beijing?
Well, you know, I think one of the big things here is women's economic independence in different parts of the world. The places that are affluent that don't have very high levels of living alone are places like, you know, Saudi Arabia, where women don't have the same mm-hmm. degree of independence. I also think a big driver of living alone is urbanization, and where you have very developed cities with booming commercial economies, you create conditions in which people can go live alone, but also be together. And so, in fact, it's not just cities around the world, but there are particular neighborhoods mm-hmm. that are that have concentrated levels of people who are going solo. And they're going solo in close proximity. They can provide each other with companionship and with support, whether they're actually speaking to each other. They can be in the same place, and that can be a tremendously rewarding experience.
It sort of reminds you of Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir lived in separate apartments for so many years in the same building.
Exactly. And I have to say, this trend of living apart together is one that a lot of social scientists are tracking now. It turns out particularly people who have been married, whether they're, kind of middle-aged adults who are divorced or separated, or older adults who are widows or widowers, increasingly people are saying, they want to have relationships. They want to have intimate ties to some other person. We're not talking about people who want to be alone, but they want to live alone and have control over their time and space, decide when they're going to spend time with their romantic partner and when they're going to spend time with friends or do their own thing. And so living apart together has become this increasing phenomenon. Interestingly, I discovered the kind of economist Joseph Schumpeter predicted that this would happen as societies became more affluent, and it turns out he was quite right about it.
And it's interesting that even during the current economic dislocation and recession, that this trend is continuing to grow.
Yeah, that's happened recently in the United States, and it also happened in Japan during their lost decade, because when you have very tough economic times, yes, living alone is a luxury and it's expensive, but also, people are reluctant to make real commitments to each other when they're concerned about their own prosperity and security, and so a lot of people delay marriage. And then on the other hand, brutal economic times are brutal on marriages. And so there are marriages that break up. So in mm-hmm. fact, we have not seen a dramatic decline in living alone. There's been a small downtick in young adults living alone. It went from about 12% of all young adults to 11% of all young adults, but that's a pretty minor downtick. And in fact, there are now far more Americans living alone in 2012 than there were in 2008 when the recession started.
How does this sort of American streak of individualism fit into this equation, do you think?
Well, I mean, it turns out that streak of individualism is not so American. We share that with that cultural value with people from many different parts of the world, including, interestingly, places like Japan or the socialist countries of Scandinavia, where their commitment to the collective and the common good is matched by their commitment to the freedom of the individual. My argument is that our independence as individuals is made possible by our interdependence as a society. It's our investment in the common good, in cities, in welfare states, things of that nature, that allow us to enjoy independence and have some choice. Where you don't have investment in the common good, living alone becomes less possible.
Coming back to where we started, because this is such a contemporary phenomenon, as we said at the outset, really since the 50s, before that you really couldn't find much of this, one wonders how, to what degree this will stick. Will this phenomenon continue to grow or itself be something that we cycle out of?
At this point, I just can't see any evidence that it's going to change. Perhaps there's, you know, some kind of economic calamity that could make it absolutely impossible. But, you know, what we're seeing today is rates of living alone increasing wherever societies can afford to do it. You know, the fact that India and China and Brazil are experiencing these dramatic increases in living alone as they grow more prosperous, mm-hmm. Is a real sign of something. And the fact that living alone is not going down, even during these hard economic times, signals that it would take something far more profound to cause a change.
Of course, the other thing that people need to be looking for, and probably why this conversation needs to happen sooner rather than later that you were talking about, is simply the broader economic and social consequences of all of this in terms of housing needs, education needs, etc., how that affects what the needs of society will be going forward.
Absolutely, and I'm very concerned about the fate of older people who live alone and get isolated. Because, you know, for some, you know, minority of people who live alone, it can become a dangerously isolating condition. You know, I learned that the hard way in my first book, which is about a heat wave in Chicago when hundreds of people died alone. I think that we need to start making a better collective investment in housing facilities that allow people to maintain their domestic autonomy as long as they want to, while also being close to social services and other kinds of support. So today, affluent older Americans can buy themselves into these assisted living facilities, which can be very nice and provide a level of support that's terrific. But they're really inaccessible for the great majority of older adults. And other countries in the world have invested more of their resources in building supportive housing of this kind. In the United States, during the recession, we've actually started to cut back services to older people who live alone, from home health care to meals on wheels and special transportation. So, you know, this is a very hard time to be doing something like that. I'm not naive. But someday we'll be out of this recession and we'll be deciding how we're going to spend our resources. And it seems to me like as we rebuild the infrastructure of this country, you know, building an infrastructure for older people who live alone serves all of our interests, because, you know, the odds are that many of us will experience that someday.
And it's all part of a trend, whether it's young or old, a trend towards greater urbanization.
That's right, and I think that's something that we need to survive as a species because of climate change. You know, the truth is, you know, living in dense urban environments, hopefully with good access to public transportation and, you know, proximity to the services we need so that we don't have to use our cars, this turns out to be much better for the environment than living in a detached and large house that needs to be heated and air-conditioned and, you know, that you need to use your car to get to and from. So, you know, in fact, well, some people have raised concerns that the rise of living alone might be bad for the environment because solos consume a lot of resources. I don't think there's much evidence that four people living alone in four relatively small urban apartments consume more energy than four people living together in a big suburban home with a couple of cars.
Right. And what does it mean, the other question, what it means for the current housing stock in the country, where we have so many of these suburbs and so many of these large single-family homes?
I think we're going to need to retrofit our suburbs, to be honest. These kind of zoning restrictions that have blocked a lot of the kind of walkable developments that people really want, especially as they get older, has meant that there are a lot of people living in suburban homes who just don't fit the place where they live anymore. They don't fit the home and they don't fit the town, and they're increasingly, you know, interested in moving back into city centers, but they're finding that the kind of rising generations don't share their interest in getting away from the city. So we have this kind of interesting moment where our suburbs might have to urbanize a little bit more.
Eric Kleinenberg, his book is Going Solo: The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone. Eric, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Hey, it's been a real pleasure.